Welcome to Sports Connections with David Smale, a podcast that brings fun and interesting connections throughout sports. As an author and sports journalist, David has been interviewing fascinating people in sports for more than 40 years. Now here's your host, David Smale.
In 1985, Al Wallace came to Kansas City after a short stint at a TV station in Las Vegas. A native Texan, Wallace probably expected Kansas City to be the next step in an upward-moving career. He wanted to be in a major league city, one that had teams in at least three of the four major sports, baseball, football, basketball, and hockey. Kansas City had three, so they fit the bill, although the NBA's Kings left shortly after he arrived. But Wallace was not expecting to be enamored with sports in Kansas City and to spend practically all of the rest of his television career here, largely because he didn't know how big college basketball was in this area. He soon found out that the inventor of basketball was the first coach at the University of Kansas, ironically, the only coach in school history with a career losing record. Now retired from television, he now teaches in the journalism department and proudly calls himself a Jayhawk. One thing Wallace did expect, however, was to work hard. He didn't mind taking the third beat behind the 85 World Series champion Royals and the Chiefs. But a work ethic instilled in him at an early age through the upbringing in a military family and enhanced by his high school football coach, Wallace always gave whatever effort was needed to get the job done, and then a little bit more. Today, we talk to Al Wallace about that work ethic and his love for Kansas City sports. Al, welcome to Sports Connections.
Thanks, David. It's interesting. We are once again connected on Sports Connections. It's good to be with you.
Thank you. Just start out just telling a little bit about your upbringing. Your dad was a career military man, and talk about how that impacted your life and specifically your love of history.
We're just going to go quick bio here, right?
So yeah, exactly.
I was born in 1957 and born into a military family. I was one of eight kids, and just like most things in life, I don't think you can realize the impact something has on your life until you've stepped away from it and are able to reflect on it and look back on it. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until basically I was out of high school and in college that I realized the impact that growing up in a military family, a large military family, the impact that it would have on my life. But I did realize growing up in the 60s as a young man, as a young boy, that that I liked history, that I liked looking back on history. In fact, I had a surreal affection for the American Revolutionary War and the Civil War because I had two older brothers, and David, we had those little army men, you know, those little plastic army men.
Yeah.
If you were in the 50s and 60s as a young man, you know, girls had Barbie dolls. We had those little army men. And so
I still have my collection, Al.
Yeah. We researched history, you know, the Battle of Shiloh and the Revolutionary War and the blue and the gray, the Yankees and the rebels. And, you know, subsequently, the New York Yankees were my favorite team because I had the Union Army when it came to those little army men.
All right. Wait a minute. The interview is now officially over. You say you're a Yankees fan. Back in the day, you were a Yankees fan, but you reformed, right? Hey,
Mickey Mantle, Joe Pepitone, Whitey Ford. I loved them all.
Okay.
But I was – that's where my love of history began as a young boy because of those little things that, you know, at the time, I was just having a good time.
Yeah.
But back to growing up in a military family, especially a large one, you know, we lived not just around the country because we moved from Army base to Army base. You know, we lived around the world literally because between the ages of seven and my ages of 7 and 10, we lived in Darmstadt, Germany. And so growing up in a military family with my dad, who was a strict disciplinarian and had everything had a place, whether it was your sock drawer, whether it was the tools in the garage, you know, you had to keep the closet a certain way. I mean, eventually I grew up living in you know, sleeping in one bedroom with three other brothers. And so you had to have your space and respect others' space mm-hmm. and things and duties and chores. And when we had dinner, unlike, you know, my kids growing up, they came in and they basically ate whatever they wanted to eat when they wanted to eat. That wasn't that way in my house.
Right.
You ate when dinner was on the table and you didn't leave the table until you ate everything. And there were many a night where I sat there an hour after everybody else had left the table. And man, those peas ain't going anywhere and you aren't either until you eat them. So it was that kind of discipline that I grew up with. Now, born in 57, we finally settled in a small community where I was actually born, west of Fort Worth, Texas, Mineral Wells, Texas, again, west of Fort Worth. And so I'm 10 years old. I'm in the fifth grade, and me and my two older brothers, we always were active in sports, Little League baseball, Pee Wee football. But by the time I was 10, 11, and, you know, getting ready to be in junior high and such, we move into a very strong Texas football community. And 99% of the communities in Texas are connected to the sport of football because they offer a lot of the things that that I would grew up with: discipline, camaraderie, mm-hmm. respect, teamwork, a sense of accomplishment, a sense of relying on others and having others rely on you. And so I began to realize those things seventh, eighth grade. So That's basically, that was my upbringing up until high school. The respect I had to learn in a large family, a military family, and living around the world, I was subjected to different cultures, mm-hmm. different kind of people. And so that's the foundation of who I am and what I love, what I liked, and what I basically turned out to be.
Now we've got viewers and listeners from around the country. You've told me before that it's not just high school football in Texas. It's Texas high school football. Explain that to us.
Well, as the old saying or slash joke goes, there are three sports in Texas: football, politics, and spring football. Mm-hmm. And the sport of football just offers so much, not to just the individual, but I believe to the family and to the community, because it's so much of what identifies one community when you compare it to another. It's football, and more often it's the high school football team, and that's why mm-hmm. high school football is so big in Texas, so important in Texas. It's so important to the community. It's so important to the culture. And it's been that way, David, and some research I've done over the last 9 months, all this, a lot of it in the South stems from the fact that the South lost the Civil War. And after the war, there were so many people in the South that were still looking for a sense of accomplishment, a sense of competitiveness. And they found a lot of that near the end of the 1800s, early 1900s. They found that in the sport of football. They found competition. Mm-hmm. They could either succeed or not succeed. And that's one reason I believe that football is so prominent now in the Southeastern Conference.
Yeah,
is because so many people in that culture, so many people in that part of the country were, after the Civil War, still looking for a sense of success, and they mm-hmm. found it, and that competitive nature, they found it in the sport of football. And so that bled over, of course, in my opinion, into the state of Texas. And that's one reason they find it so important there, not just to the players or the coaches or the team or the school, but to the community, to the cheerleaders, to the booster club, to the identity of that town, because it gives that town, it gives that community something to look forward to,
mm-hmm.
each and every week leading up to one game in the fall. Only 10 games, but so much of their year is built around that fall football season.
Now, speaking of football, you were also impacted by your, at first, your middle school coach, who eventually became the high school coach, if my history is correct, with the idea, which ended up becoming a book, One for the Coyotes. Talk about that concept.
Well, I believe that here in Kansas City, this philosophy has been adopted since the early 90s, late 90s, somewhere in there, that the head coach of a high school, let's take hypothetically a community like Lee Summit.
Okay,
because we're all in the Kansas City area familiar with Lee Summit, or perhaps Lee Summit High School football. So several junior highs in that area feed different high schools.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was in junior high, my high school was fed by three different junior highs. And each junior high football team had a head coach, but the head coach of the high school team was also the athletic director. And so this is late 60s now, not 90s. This is late 60s in Texas. The head coach of the high school team was Frank Beavers, and he was also the athletic director. So of all the schools. So his philosophy was, I'm going to run this kind of offense. I'm going to run this kind of defense. I'm going to run this kind of off-season program. Mm-hmm. He had the foundation laid for the high school team, but that bled down, that filtered down to the junior high school teams as well. So everything they did in high school, they also did on the junior high level. So it was all one big administration, if you will. It was one big formula. So if you're in the seventh grade and you're running one kind of offense, by the time you get to high school, you're still running that offense. Well, you've been living on this offense or this defense or whatever for the last 4 years, so you're extremely familiar with it. Mm-hmm. It's just a systematic. It was a marvel at the time,
right?
And so that's what I grew up with. But his philosophy. When I'm in junior high, to make it to the high school team, that was the goal. And so you lived and you understood and studied those philosophies and those rules and those regulations and those nuances.
Mm-hmm.
So, but throughout that time, we had success on the high school and junior high level, but not like one team in our district, which was Wichita Falls High School. And Wichita Falls High School, between a history again here, right? Between the late or mid 40s, 1940s, and the mid to late 1960s, about a two-decade time period, they won six state championships. And they didn't just win our district. They weren't just the best team in our district. They were the best team in the state
mm-hmm.
of Texas. And they were the Coyotes. And they were simply flat out, in a word, good. They had Division I athletes, skilled players, linemen, people in this area remember in the mid to late 70s, a running back in Nebraska by the name of Richard Burns.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Coyote. If you remember those Darrell Royal teams at the University of Texas in the 1960s, they had a running back on some of those James Street teams, a running back by the name of Joy Abusi. He was a Coyote.
Okay.
Of course, I had a quarterback by the name of Ronnie Littleton, who was just marvelous. He was just really good. But anyway, they would beat us when I was in high school. The Coyotes would beat us 72-0, 65-0. They were just that good because they would send three or four or five players on each team to major Division I schools. But we tried to compete. We were just never really successful. And our head coach knew that. Frank Beavers knew that. And to motivate us, while we were preparing for a game or a season or an off season, because in Texas, you don't just have the season that goes from late August through Thanksgiving. you have an off-season program that starts in January, ends in March. Then you have spring football. Then you have a spring game. And this is late 60s. We had a spring game in high school. And so throughout that entire process, whenever we were working out, doing drills, off-season, in-season, whatever, he always required us to have the mentality of do what you got to do the best you can do it, but always do it a little bit more. So if you're doing 10 of something, 10 laps, 10 sprints, 10 reps on the bench, 10 reps with the rope, do 10, but then do one more. Do one for the Coyotes, because that is what's going to get you over the hump, is to have that attitude, one for the Coyotes. So I grew up, from a football standpoint, I grew up with that mentality to, quote unquote, do one for the Coyotes. Do a little bit, do whatever you have to do to succeed, but yeah, do a little bit more to be able to not only compete with the best, but beat the best. That's what it's going to take. And so that's the basically the mantra of my competitive nature, my work ethic.
Yeah,
I guess you could say that's where that came from.
And it helped you from a football standpoint, because you were part of the all-decade team in the 70s for the Mineral Wells Rams, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
but it also helped you in your work, in your 40-year career as a sports television broadcaster. Just talk about how that attitude of, you know, nothing is too menial for me. Nothing is too, I whatever I need to do, I need to give 100% effort, and then I need to do a little bit more. Talk about how that impacted you.
Well, I you know, like so many things, David, and I said this a bit earlier. I think most often you don't realize, most people, I certainly didn't realize the impact of something until I was able to step away from it, mm-hmm, understand what it meant to me, how important it was to any success that I was having, and then use it in another way, shape, or form. So I had all that discipline. I had all that motivation growing up in a military family and growing up in Texas high school football. By the time I got to college, one thing I never did in high school or in college is I didn't apply any of those lessons to my studies. I had terrible study habits. And by the time I was a junior in college, my third year in college, I was looking for a sense of self. I was looking for a sense of belonging, because I was no longer playing football. I was out in the world of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm looking, you know, I always wanted my dream job was to be a sportscaster, and I'm looking for a sense of belonging as I'm majoring in telecommunications at Texas Tech University. And I'm looking for something to grab onto. So I go back to school. I stayed at home that summer, 1978. And I go back to school, and I'm walking across campus, and I see an old friend of mine from a class, and I asked her, hey, what'd you do during the summer, that kind of thing. And she said, I stayed here in Lubbock, and I worked at a TV station. And I couldn't believe it that she had worked at a TV station. I mean, that was just, she might as well have been a movie star, or, you know, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And she told me, she said, hey, there's some openings, you should go apply. So I did. I went and applied at this TV station, the ABC affiliate there in Lubbock. And I wound up getting a job. $2.90 an hour. I was working about 20 hours a week. And I couldn't believe it that I got a job at a TV station. Sweeping floors and running prompter. I mean, a monkey could do that, with all due respect to monkeys. And and I got this job. And David, I soon realized that all those things that had helped me while I was in high school playing football, and living, growing up in a large military family, and having to share, mm-hmm, and having to grow and learn and respect. I got all those things in television. So when I was in TV, I learned very quickly that I no longer had one game every week on Friday nights because we had two newscasts every day that required teamwork and accomplishment and reliance on one another. I didn't have one game a week. I had two games every day for a 6 and 10 o'clock newscast. And so I used the lessons that I'd learned earlier in life, especially from football, and dedication and discipline. I used all those things that I'd learned at home and in football. I put those to work in my television career.
And you were, so, I was going to say, you were in Lubbock for a few, for 7 years, I believe. And then you went to Las Vegas for a few months. And even the, even that one for the Coyotes work ethic helped you land a job in Kansas City, which is how most of us have come to know you. So tell that story in Vegas.
I took a job in Las Vegas. Actually, I was in Lubbock for 9.5 years.
9 years,
from the time I left high school until January of 1985. So I took a job in Las Vegas only because I needed to leave Lubbock. I was just, I'd been there too long and I didn't want to wither away in Lubbock, which is what I was doing.
Yeah.
And so I took a job in Las Vegas, not really wanting it, but I needed to leave and go somewhere. So I took this job. And when I first moved there, the deal was I would, they fired the weekend sports guy and the main sports guy. And I was going to do weekends. And then they were going to get their main news anchor to do, to be the main sports guy. And I was going to anchor weekends. But when I first moved there, I worked every day for 30 days. And I was the only sports guy. And I was burned out. I was burned out after a week or 10 days. and I hated living in Las Vegas. I didn't like the station. I didn't like being alone. I didn't like anything.
But you kept going. I kept applying.
I kept going, and I took one day off because I needed it bad. And they got the weekend weather guy to do sports. I went down to Caesar's Palace, and I saw Diana Ross in concert. And I put on my best suit because the last time I had a drink of liquor was 1985, February 1985. The last time I bought, you know, I drink, you know, I'll have a beer every once in a while now. But the last time I bought liquor was that night because I was going to have a good time by myself. And anyway, I go back to work. And finally, at the end of February, after working for 4 weeks straight, My first full day off was coming the next day, and the main sports guy is going to take over. Well, the night before my first day off, I'm at work, and he calls me from home, and he says, "Hey, look, if you could just come in tomorrow and just help me get a few things, put a few things together, man, I'd really appreciate it." And my work ethic told me, just do this one last thing to help the team be successful. Why not come in on the day off for 1 hour just to help this guy out?
And after 30 straight days.
Yes. After 30 straight days, I said, yes, I'll do that. I'll do one for the Coyotes. I'll do one for the team success. I came in to work on that day off. I stayed for 1 hour. And as I'm walking out the back door, going to my car in the parking lot, a guy sticks his head out the back door and says, "Hey, Al, you got a phone call." And I run back in to get the phone call. And it was Mike Lewis, the news director at WDAF-TV in Kansas City. I had applied there about 9 months before. I'd sent a resume tape to Kansas City. And I don't, you know, it, they didn't have any openings or whatever. I didn't even get a letter back saying, "Don't call us, we'll call you." But yeah, they called me then. I wouldn't have gotten that phone call if I wouldn't have made that extra effort to go into work that day to help that guy out, to help the team out. I wouldn't have done it. So my work ethic absolutely paid off to me being able to spend the better part of 33 years on the air here in Kansas City.
I wanted you to tell that story. I'd heard the story before, and I think it definitely gives our listeners and our viewers an idea of how that idea, or how that work ethic applies. When you got to Kansas City in April of 1985, KU basketball had just won the national championship. The Royals were preparing for their world championship season. They had made the playoffs the year before. It was kind of the heyday for Kansas City sports, or one of the heydays of Kansas City sports. And you got the third beat. You didn't get the Royals. You didn't get the Chiefs. You got the third beat of college basketball in the area. that made a major impact for you, didn't it?
Well, yeah, it did. And in fact, at that time, you know, my first day at work was May 8th, 1985. And at that time, we actually had four people in our sports department. Denny Treese was the play-by-play guy for the Royals, but he was also on our staff at WDAF-TV. Uh-huh. Frank Bowe was a sports director, and Gordon Docking was also on staff. So those three guys had been there for a while, and I was basically the number four guy. Mm. And didn't matter to me. I was on a team. That's all. I just wanted to be on a team in a major league market. I mean, I didn't need the big leagues. And it was just great. But there was no one, you know, there was no assignment to cover college football or college basketball. My basic assignment was to make sure we didn't miss anything on the high school level. Well, hell, I'd grown up with high school football. I thought that was great. And it was, in my opinion, maybe not the right word to use here, it was simply by accident that I fell in love with college football, college basketball. Hmm. Well, who wouldn't fall in love with a venue like Allen Fieldhouse or Ahern Arena or the Hearn Center over in Columbia when you've got, my gosh, these three schools all in the Big Eight that through six games – just had so much to offer. I had never seen college athletes on a basketball court that skilled.
Yeah.
I grew up in Texas. It was football. And yeah, I'd seen Phi Slamma Jamma, and I'd seen the triplets at Arkansas and Eddie Sutton coaching those teams. But every team that came to these different venues that I just mentioned, they were all good. They were all like that. And to have the, you know, Allen Fieldhouse with Danny Manning and in his early years at KU and in Larry Brown coaching, it wasn't love at first sight, but it certainly caught my eye. And more than that, I just thought it was in the atmosphere and all these places, you know, David, I watched KU play at Ahern against K-State from that press box area, which was way up in the rafters.
Yeah.
And then I did a live shot one time at Ahern right on the baseline. During a game, I was on the baseline doing a live shot, and there were fans standing in between me and the basketball goal. You could basically be in the game.
Yeah.
And I'd never viewed or covered a sporting event of that caliber, that high caliber, from that close up. And it was fantastic.
And plus, you have to drive up Naismith Drive to get to Allen Fieldhouse. And you know that I'm a K-Stater, but I am not ashamed to admit that I've been a countless college basketball arenas around the country. Allen Fieldhouse is hands down the best college basketball atmosphere. And that's the last nice thing I'm going to say about KU today. So KU became, you know, you became a fan of college basketball with all of those, you know, all those schools in the area, but KU specifically is very important to you. And not because of basketball, but because of an event that happened on November 24th, 1991. Talk about the sports side of it and then talk about why it's personal for you.
First, the sports side, it was a Kansas hosting Missouri football game at Memorial Stadium in Lawrence. And I think, you know, we all know what that's about. I'm a history lover. And, you know, to be honest with you, to me, every time those two schools meet in anything, basketball, football, tiddlywinks. It dates back to the Civil War.
Yeah.
And I love the rivalry, I'll put it that way. But that was the day that, and I don't remember the exact score. I've never really looked it up, but I do know that Kansas won the game, and it was highlighted by a 396-yard rushing day by running back Tony Sands. And he set an NCAA single-game record that stood for more than 20 years. Mm-hmm. I think it was finally broken in 2016 or 17 when Kansas played at Oklahoma. And another story. But on that day that Tony Sands ran for that NCAA single game rushing record against Missouri, that's the day that I met my wife on the press box elevator. And
this is a good, you need to give us a little bit of detail here because this is a very
good story. Well, I go to the game with my photographer, Donnie Proctor, at the time. And we were with an intern, Lori Calcara, who's a KU grad, but she was also at the time, they used to call them Crimson Girls. And so we get on the elevator. I don't know if it was the three of us, and certainly me and Lori, we get on the elevator, and I noticed the elevator operator, who was just the most gorgeous thing I'd ever seen in my life, this woman. And, you know, we're on this rinky-dink elevator, and I don't know, 10 people squeezed in tight. And so we get up to the press box, and we get off the elevator. And I asked Lori, I said, did you notice the girl on the elevator? And she said, yeah, I noticed. And I noticed you noticed, because I guess I couldn't take my eyes off of her. So I found reason, stupidly, during that game, to ride that elevator about 10 times just so I could talk to her. And I did. I went home that night and I called my brother and I said, I met my wife today. Now, that's a bold statement to make.
Yeah.
And a bold assertion to make, because I didn't see her again for another 2.5 months. Yeah, for me, it was love at first sight. And to this day, she is my wife. So that is a connection, David, which I find interesting. And I'm sure that's why you asked the question. One reason I do like sports is because you can relate so many important events in your life. A sporting event can serve as a timestamp.
Yes.
To so many important events in our lives, and we are able to use sporting events as a barometer on the timeline of our lives.
Right.
Well, I remember that day because the day before, that's the day Joe Blow hit a home run, and that was two right. days after George Brett did this, or the day Lynn Dawson did that, and then we came home, and then we did this. We enjoyed the game, and then we got all that snow, remember? And blah, blah, yeah. blah. So, that started my affection, my true affection for the city of Lawrence, Kansas, because my wife was born in Lawrence, insisted that both our daughters be born in Lawrence, even though we lived in the Kansas City metro, and they were, and one has already graduated from the University of Kansas, and one is now a junior at KU.
All right. Now you came to Kansas City in 1985. You retired from WDAF at the end of 2018. But you left Kansas City for a short period of time to return to Dallas, to the Metroplex. You went back home to a bigger city, a bigger market, but you came back pretty quickly. Why?
I left for 13 months. And I left Kansas City for 13 months. And I came back because a couple of reasons. Number one, when I lived in Dallas, I was single and I had no life. I lived at work. Hmm. And I longed for a sense of, even though my family was there, both my parents at the time were still living. They both passed away now. But I thought I was going to be closer to family. And actually, I wasn't, because I didn't have time for them. Mm. If I did get a day off, I felt obligated to see them. And I had no time for myself. And when I moved to Dallas, Fort Worth, in July of 1989, it was on the tail end of Jimmy Johnson taking the head coaching job with the Dallas Cowboys, hired by the new owner, Jerry Jones. So I was there for the first training camp of Jimmy and Jerry, that first season where they went 1-15. Mm. And I lived at work. SMU was coming off the death penalty. And so I was covering that. I was also covering Texas high school football. I had no life.
Yeah.
And when I lived in Kansas City, I moved here and realized very quickly, man, this is something I did on my own. I didn't do this with any part of my family. I didn't do this because it was close, like Texas Tech was to my hometown. I moved to an entirely different part of the country by myself. I enjoyed it. I loved it. And I had an opportunity to move back here. And 13 months after I left Kansas City, I found myself back after being offered an opportunity to come back. And I'm absolutely glad I did.
And that was in 1990. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So just another 15, 16 months before November 24th of 1991. So who knows if that encounter would have happened. What does this area mean to you? You've retired from television. Now you're teaching at KU, but you could go anywhere you wanted, but you've stayed in Kansas City. What does this area mean to you?
Kansas City is as big as you want it to be, David. It's as small as you want it to be. And I visited, you know, New York and L.A. Even when I moved to Dallas, I lived in my car.
Yeah.
I was there 13 months. I put 35,000 miles on my car. In Kansas City, I truly believe you can get it. You can get anywhere you want to be in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes it'll take you 35 or 40, but it's not like you have to plan half your day to do it.
Yeah.
And Kansas City just has so much to offer as far as comfortability, in living. It doesn't take you long to get anywhere in town, or if you want to travel, it doesn't take you half a day. Well, it does take you half a day sometimes, but it just doesn't take forever to get there. I like the location. I've gotten past the fact that I grew up in Texas, and I know the winters here can be brutal. Not all of them are, but they can be. Mm-hmm. I've gotten past that. When I first moved here, I hated it. I've gotten used to it. It is what it is. I don't like raking leaves all the time, but you know, it's just one of the things. I mean, come on. I'm sitting here griping about raking leaves. I'm not sitting here griping about the price of bread and the price of a mortgage and living space. So affordable. It's so friendly. It's everything I thought it was when I originally left in 1989. It hasn't changed. The people here are just so good. I'm glad I raised my family here. Great education, great family atmosphere, and those things are really important to me as I reflect on back the way I grew up. Family has always been extremely, extremely important to me.
And you mentioned people. I want you to just briefly talk about some of the, not everybody, because that would take another couple of hours, but some of the people that meant so much to you in your 33 years at WDAF. Just mention a couple of them.
Well, I'll start at the top from an administration standpoint. I got hired here by a news director by the name of Mike Lewis, and his boss, who was had a title right up under the general manager, was Mike McDonald. So Mike McDonald basically was my first news director. He hired me. He moved to Dallas, hired me in Dallas, and then was able to bring me back. He is without a doubt the best newsman I've ever known in my life. And I love television news. I love television news. I'm going to be point blank right here. I do not believe in fake news.
Yeah.
If it's fake, it's not news.
Right.
I don't believe in fake news. And Mike McDonald didn't either. So I got a lot of my news sense from him. And then, of course, you know, my first true real boss that I just so much respect for, a great friend of mine, is Frank Bohl, who was, you know, a couple of years ago went into the Missouri Sports Hall of Fame. I owe so much to him. You know, Frank would always say around the office that the sports department there was not a dictatorship. It was a democracy. I had the perfect job when Frank Bohl was the main anchor at WDAF. He let me do whatever I wanted to do. He let me do whatever I wanted to do, as long as I did it well, mm-hmm. as long as I could do what I say I was going to do with a story. He let me do it, and I owe him so much. And a couple of other guys, you know, of course, J.W. Edwards, who I traveled across this country with. He's a photographer, photojournalist. He has since retired from television. Last year he did, in 2019, about 6 months after I did, he left television. So I'm glad I got out before he did, because I'd have been, you know, you know, I traveled literally thousands and hundreds of thousands of miles across this country with J.W. Edwards, and also Donnie Proctor, who is a Mizzou grad. And I never asked Donnie to do anything. I never asked him to do something, and he said no. Hmm. He was just always willing to work. Those guys, the work ethic, and we just, as much as anything, working with those three guys, we just had so much fun. It was always a good time going to work. Sometimes it was work. And sometimes, you know, you or I or anyone, you know, hey, I don't want to go to work today. I had those days.
Yeah.
Most often it was just a really good time from guys that appreciated me, and Lord knows I certainly appreciated them.
All right. As we wrap up here, couple of things. What are you passionate about outside of sports? I know prostate cancer awareness is part of that. What really gets you fired up now that you're out of TV news?
I would say, David, not much gets me fired up. Not much.
Okay.
I had no idea. As we tape this, I had no idea two nights ago that K-State played a basketball game on the road at Iowa State until like 30 minutes before tip off. What fires me up is, first of all, family and being able to be with my family, being able to be with my family. That excites me. And the amount of time that I have with them, especially in this pandemic, I don't mind at all being locked, being shut down and locked up. And I'm passionate about fighting cancer because I did get, you know, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer in October of 2011, and I had prostate cancer removal surgery 3 months later. Everything's fine. I didn't have to go chemo. I didn't have to do radiation. I had my prostate removed. I'm passionate about that. But here recently, I am passionate. I'll be honest with you. And yeah, this is political. I'm passionate about the direction of our country. I lost my brother right around a year ago to a shooting in a church. And so I am passionate about stopping the hate in this country. I am passionate about that.
Yeah.
I don't know what I can do. I do not know what I can do as an individual, but I'm just, I am passionate about, let's stop it. Let's stop it. So those are some of the things I'm passionate about.
Very well stated, Al. You and I are probably a little different politically, but we agree on that. We've got to figure out something to stop the hatred. How we do it, maybe we have different opinions, but we've got to stop that. So that's very well stated. All right, I'm going to wrap up with this. I had the privilege and the honor of working with you on your book, where many of these stories that you've shared today are part of. The title of the book, obviously, One for the Coyotes. So just talk about that process and talk about how people can get a copy. It's by the time this airs, it's after Christmas, but it's not too late to get a gift for somebody. I believe the story is well told. You're a professional communicator, so it was easy for me to take our interviews and put them into first person narrative, but you tell good stories and you talk about more than just covering sports. You know, we're just sports writers, sportscasters, whatever. You talk about how all these things that you're passionate about helped you in many, many areas of life. Just talk about the process and then how people can get copies of the book.
I never, not for once, not for a half a second in any time in my life up until January of 2019 did I think that I would become an author and write a book, certainly not a book about myself. So you helped tremendously with that. And I'm very thankful for that. But I do love the accomplishment of writing the book because I was able to tell my story, just from a people standpoint. I love people. I love talking to people. I love communicating with people. My family will tell you, I probably like it too much, because we don't go out as much as we used to because of the pandemic. I still like connecting with people, and the book allowed me to do that. The book is entitled One for the Coyotes, you know, how I survived 40 years of my dream job in television broadcasting and cancer too. So there's some cancer, some about my cancer in the book, my fight against cancer and losing a good friend to cancer. Three chapters in the book deal heavily with the University of Kansas and basketball. There's a lot of history in the book, my history, my affection for history, my affection for Texas high school football, and most of all, my affection for family. You can find the book at alwallacemedia.com. I say log on, give it a look, and give it a buy. And thank you again, David, for helping me with the book.
Yeah, and we'll have that link underneath this video. And if you're listening only on a podcast, it's alwallacemedia.com. And I'm not unbiased, but I think it's a great book. I think you do a great job telling your story. So, Al, let's wrap up with this. Your excitement for the Chiefs. I know you're really excited that you don't have to travel with them during the playoffs. You don't have to follow them. You don't have to know why Patrick Mahomes is just doing absolutely ridiculous stuff. You can just enjoy it. Are you still rooting for the Chiefs?
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. Rooting for the Chiefs. My biggest takeaway from what the Chiefs have done since I left television. I thought for years, David, that the best football player I ever saw wearing a Chiefs uniform was Derek Thomas. Because every time when Derek Thomas played for the Chiefs on defense, every time the other team's offense broke the huddle, that quarterback had to think to himself, where is Derek Thomas? Because right. He was a game changer.
Right.
He was a difference maker. And I always had Derek Thomas at the top of my list. Not anymore. He's not even 1B. He is number two. And yeah. He is behind Patrick Mahomes. I just think he is the biggest game changer in the history of this franchise. And if you don't believe me, believe your lying eyes when you look at that Super Bowl trophy. And I just think he is just – I think he is just tremendous. I just – I'm wowed almost every time I watch him play.
Yeah.
Almost every time.
All right. Well, I appreciate you being on with me, Al. This was a great time. You know, I enjoyed – our time sitting in that very room where you are right now doing the interviews for the book. And it's always good to visit with you. And I appreciate you being on the show today.
It's been a pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you, David.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smale. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smale and his work by visiting davidsmalebooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.